This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
It's time. Time for your weekly appointment with the only man who could host a four-hour Saturday tour de force of sports talk on CBS Sports Radio. Why? Why did we select this man to undertake this Herculean task? Because, well, his name is on the marquee. Here he is, Robin Lundberg.
Show coming to you live from the Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans Studios. When you want the ability to adjust your loan options in real time, Rocket can. Talked a lot of NBA in the show, reacting to the Lakers' loss to the Rockets in Game 1. How much of that is concern for the Lakers? How much is that the feel-out game for LeBron? How much of that should be on Frank Vogel? I thought his coaching last night was abysmal. They have to consider firing him before Game 2. Just kidding on that latter aspect, but it was really bad. In Game 1. However, you know, typically LeBron James teams have used Game 1 as a bit of a feel-out process. The Rockets, though, dangerous with their style of play. Obviously, James Harden, Russell Westbrook, P.J. Tucker was really impressive last night defensively for them. Meanwhile, the Bucks are on the brink. You know, what does that mean for the way Giannis is looked at, where he might be in the future? Talk to the Steve Nash hiring with the Brooklyn Nets, some of the reaction to that. In my opinion, Steve Nash mostly got that job because he's Steve Nash, and there has been a precedent for great players getting coaching jobs right away, for heady winning guards getting coaching jobs right away. First-year coaches have done well of late. The last three NBA champions had first-year coaches, and he had the personal connection with Sean Marks, the GM, having played with him in Phoenix, and the star players vouching for him, especially his personal relationship with Kevin Durant. But we're getting to some NFL, been talking some NFL. We'll get back to the NBA, but I ask you what storyline you're most looking forward to this NFL season. As does it seem real right now? Like, are you actually ready for some football? CBS Sports Radio's toll-free line, 855-212-4227, is sponsored by Geico. Did you know that right now Geico is offering an extra 15% credit on car, motorcycle, and RV policies? That's on top of what Geico could already save you. So what are you waiting for? Visit Geico.com to learn more. How about Alan in Chicago? Alan, you're up next here on CBS Sports Radio.
It doesn't surprise me whatsoever that Trubisky was named the starter, but I will tell you this. His leash is going to be so short. I don't want to hear nothing about tip balls, overthrow, nothing. They will yank him in a New York second because there ain't no way we're going to put up with the way he played last year. That's just my comment.
So you're saying essentially this is his last chance and it's going to be a short window before Nick Foles would see the field?
No question. I think they're basically putting him in there to save face. They picked him. They thought he was the guy. Well, I didn't even know. What was his QBR rating last year? 40? I don't even know. I mean, it was dreadful. Okay. And when the guy takes the field and he gets booed, they're going to put him in. They're going to keep him on a very, very short leash, because the fans won't put up with it, and then they're going to yank them and see what happens with Foles.
Well, I mean, you may be correct on that, of course, and Nick Foles is a proven guy, being that he won a Super Bowl with the Eagles. Didn't work out for him so much in Jacksonville. He got injured there, though, of course. We'll see. I mean, I think you're probably right. I mean, I do agree that the leash on him will be short, but I don't know. Why would you name him the starter to save face anymore? I kind of feel like they're already past that. So I would hope they thought he gives them the best chance, and it isn't about salvaging any reputation or anything like that. They're just
We'll see. But they certainly got the defense. And if he's only throwing 17 touchdowns, then ain't going to cut it. Defense can't carry you all the way.
No, I agree. And thanks for the call. I mentioned that before. The 17 touchdowns is, you got to put up more points than that. Sorry. Like, I don't care who you are, what team you're starting for. 17 touchdowns is not an acceptable number in the NFL today. I believe his QBR was 41.5, by the way, last year, since you had asked about that specific stat. But to me, the thing that stood out was the lack of production putting the ball in the end zone. 17, when you got guys throwing 40 or 50 or whatnot nowadays, that's not going to do it. How about Joe in Abilene, Texas? Joe, you're up next here on CBS Sports Radio.
Hey, brother. How are you this morning?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great. So whenever I was a young sports guy, there was a lot more talk about, the unbreakable records, the hallowed records. Some of them have been broken, like Marino's 48 touchdowns, 47 consecutive games, I think it was, with the United that Breeze broke for touchdown passes. Some of them haven't been broken, DiMaggio's 56-game hitting streak. But one that people are not talking about this year that I was always aware of was the Cowboys and Tom Landry's 20-year streak of winning seasons. I listen to sports radio all the time, and I haven't heard a single person talk about the fact that Belichick and the Patriots can tie that record this year. I don't know. Were you aware of that?
To be honest, I wasn't. I think with Belichick, it's just like he's gotten so much credit for how consistently the Patriots have won and for how long they've won. But as far as comparing it to one individual record, no, I actually hadn't heard that either.
Right. Another parallel I'd like to draw with that is the fact that, like Landry, which Belichick has a lot of respect for Landry. He talks about him all the time, is the fact that Landry had his hands directly in the offense and defense most of the game. And I think, pretty much Belichick does too. So, while I'm not rooting for him to break the record, I certainly respect the Patriots. I'm a Cowboys fan. So anyway, that's all I had for you, bud.
Yeah. I think I'm looking at it now. I think it's 18 straight seasons for Belichick with a winning record at the moment, and I think the record is 20. So maybe that's a reason it hasn't – but this is from 2019. So, no, you're correct because this is an older article. So, yeah, he can tie him this season if my quick initial read on that is correct for most consecutive winning seasons. That is not something I had known about. I mean, we're already – talking about Belichick in terms of the greatest coach of all time, but as far as another statistical achievement, that would be one that goes there. But I think what people are really looking forward to seeing from Belichick is how he does without Brady and vice versa. I mean, that's the storyline of this NFL season, unquestionably. How does Tom Brady do with the Buccaneers, and how does Bill Belichick do with Cam Newton at the helm in New England? Quincy in Alabama. Quincy, you're up next here on CBS Sports Radio. What's going on, Quincy?
Hey, Robert. How you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Pretty good. The storyline I'm looking most forward to is how Jalen Hurts will do in Philadelphia, given Carson Wentz's injury history. Because even though Carson Wentz is a good quarterback, he's proven to be very fragile.
Yeah, and that was a draft pick that was criticized a little bit, right? I like the pick because I think Hurts is the kind of guy that can help you in other ways, and it is also like it's good to have a backup quarterback and a possible option for the future for all those things you mentioned. But when you say the storyline you're most looking forward to, are you then working under the assumption that Carson Wentz is going to get hurt?
Yes. I think he doesn't seem like he ever plays a full season. And even in their biggest game, he was on the bench because he was hurt. That's just what he does.
Yeah, he has gotten injured throughout the course of his career. I don't want to just assume anybody's getting injured. And thanks for the call. And I want to wish everybody the best health. Obviously, football is a dangerous sport. But if Jalen Hurts is simply insurance, we all pay for our insurance, right? Anybody out there getting their insurance for free? Let me know. Because those are those bills that piss you off, right? Like, you know, hey, I got to pay this and it gives me nothing unless I'm dead. you know, so, or, but we all need it. I mean, obviously, health insurance is the kind of topic it is for how important it is and how expensive it is. And I don't want to, you know, equate that to NFL football, obviously, but in insurance, that's what a backup quarterback is. Because look at the Eagles firsthand. I mean, they won a Super Bowl with their backup quarterback. They won a Super Bowl with their backup quarterback. Chad in Jacksonville. Chad, you're up next here on CBS Sports Radio. What's going on, Chad?
Hey, what's going on? I got a quick comment on the Jaguars. Are we really, you know, I'm looking forward to seeing, are we really going to be as bad as everybody thinks we are? I think the answer is yes. We keep dumping pieces. And then second comment I wanted to make, we were talking about Nick Foles. You know, I think he's having a huge impact in the locker room with all these quarterbacks he's working with, and I'm wondering if we're going to see Trubisky actually have a decent year with him being in the locker room. Minshew had a great year with him mentoring him. I'm sure Wentz, you know, he played a role in Wentz's development while he was there. So I wouldn't be surprised if we see Trubisky actually have a better year than people are thinking.
Hey, you never know. And that is part of the, you know, the process of giving him another crack at it, I guess. I mean, he still is relatively young. Sometimes guys figure it out. I can't tell you I have much confidence that that's going to happen. Again, this is the time of year where people sort of talk themselves in to anything, including that resurgent year from Trubisky. But we're not talking about a second year anymore. You know, if it's going to happen, it better be happening now. I mean, this is what, Trubisky's fourth year? Going into his fourth year in the NFL?
Yeah.
So, I mean, what do you expect from Mitch Trubisky?
I'm not expecting, I don't think we're going to see big things, but, you know, we talk about, you know, improvements, and I just feel like I could see some improvement numbers this year. You know, maybe not enough to keep him around long term, but you know, I could maybe see him and holding on to the starting job a little bit longer than just the first couple weeks.
Well, you hope when you get named the starter, it's not so that you can be pulled, right? Like that makes no sense to me to name someone the starter so you can pull them later. You name them the starter because hopefully they're the starter and they're good enough to be the starter. I just think we've seen a broad enough sample size now from Trubisky where he has we're beyond the benefit of the doubt. I guess that's the way I put it. The onus is now on Trubisky. And again, I was sort of trying to defend the guy earlier, and thanks for the call, because it was a we treat him so harshly for someone who's not actually terrible at his job. He's just not what you want from where he was drafted or what you want from a top-shelf starting quarterback in the NFL. You know, if Trubisky was your backup, you'd be looking at things a lot differently. You know, if you wound up hearing that he left the Bears and signed somewhere else to be the backup, people would feel a lot differently about how they evaluate him. But right now, he's still being evaluated by his draft status, you know, and where he went. And with the knowledge that the Chicago Bears are a good team, right? Like otherwise, they're the kind of team that people expect to compete aside from the quarterback. And when you're drafted second overall and Patrick Mahomes goes 10th and Deshaun Watson goes 12th, there's going to be some question marks. Now, those question marks should exist for all those other teams, by the way, honestly, too. It's not just the Bears. It's just because they're quarterback. I mean, Myles Garrett went number one overall. You know, I mean, Myles Garrett's a terrific player. I don't care what the situation is. Patrick Mahomes should have gone number one. I don't care who you had already in place. Patrick Mahomes should have gone number one. But, you know, you can't really kill them for the Myles Garrett pick. But beyond that, well, Patrick Mahomes should have gone. Or Deshaun Watson should have gone. And you see Solomon Thomas, Leonard Fournette, Corey Davis, Jamal Adams, a good pick at number six, but Patrick Mahomes should have gone. Deshaun Watson should have gone. Mike Williams at number seven. Then you get to Christian McCaffrey. So, I mean, that's pretty amazing. When you look back at that draft, that Christian McCaffrey, Patrick Mahomes, Deshaun Watson were all in that draft, and the highest any of them was picked was number 8. Number 8. That, you know, it's not a perfect science, clearly. Clearly not a perfect science, and we've seen evidence of that over and over again. But at this point, you almost have to get beyond, all right, Mitch Trubisky was drafted ahead of Patrick Mahomes and Deshaun Watson, therefore he needs to be at that level. That's not never going to happen, right? He's never going to be at that level. Can he be good enough? I think that's the question he's got to answer. Can he be good enough? And thus far, that answer has been no. How much does he have to improve to get to that level? I don't know. I think he's high-level backup right now. Low-level starter. High-level backup, low-level starter, which isn't bad in the grand scheme of things, but certainly isn't good enough for the Chicago Bears to be contenders. 855-212-4227, 855-212-4227. You can also get at me online at Robin Lundberg on Twitter. Talked a lot of NBA earlier in the show, but there are a lot of NBA storylines to get to because you had playoff games last night. Lakers lose, Bucks on the brink, and in addition, the Steve Nash hiring by the Brooklyn Nets being a big talking point. Some tweets still coming in on that. Don C. Williams Jr., I agree with your point about having outrage over Steve Nash. There are plenty more legitimate issues. My problem is how the only thing some are focusing on is race, not the fact that Durant lobbied for him and he has a relationship with the GM. I mean, that was part of the points I was making when I was saying he's qualified. There are connections there. You know, there's his Hall of Fame stature as a player. There's the position he played. There's the player on the team or players on the team who wanted him, and the GM. Shell R tweets in, you mentioned a couple years ago when there were 12 to 14 African-American coaches in the NBA. When the caller mentioned there were 5 now, that's not really saying much. There's definitely a disparity. Well, my point was that there had been a drop-off there, that there it was at a level that I don't think anyone would point to and say what was problematic, and it has fallen, so it's worth exploring. All right, are guys, you know, are black coaches being fired earlier than white coaches? Are they not getting second opportunities, you know, as quickly as white coaches? Those sort of things, I think, are very valid. I just didn't think the white privilege point worked in Steve Nash's case, given that great players have gotten jobs when they've wanted them. Magic Johnson, Isaiah Thomas, Larry Bird, Jason Kidd, and now Steve Nash. And that like I said, winning heady guards have gotten jobs right away. Derek Fisher, Mark Jackson, two of the best coaches in the league right now, Steve Kerr and Doc Rivers. And given that, you know, first-year coaches have succeeded as of late. Nick Nurse, Tyronn Lue, and Steve Kerr were all first-year coaches. Those are the last 3 NBA championship teams. And because Kevin Durant vouched for him and because the GM had a personal connection. We'll get back to those topics out of the NBA coming up next. It is the Robin Lundberg Show, and it's here with you on CBS Sports Radio.
Retweet and follow Robin Lundberg. His Twitter handle is easy to remember, at Robin Lundberg.
Really been talking about 3 storylines throughout the NBA today. The Lakers lost to the Rockets last night. The Bucks on the brink of elimination at the hands of the Miami Heat. And the Brooklyn Nets hiring of Steve Nash. And to get deeper into each of those, I'm joined now by Howard Beck, Bleacher Report senior NBA writer. And Howard, I feel like we've been through reacting to a LeBron game 1 before, and it's always tough to know how far to go.
I mean, there is no nuance when it comes to any LeBron discussion, so I wouldn't expect any with this situation either. You know, listen, the Rockets were – it was a struggle for them in the first round and very short turnaround time, but it got them in a nice rhythm. I think the Rockets were kind of ready to go and knew what they wanted to do last night, and the Lakers had been off for a little bit. And, you know, the Rockets are a really weird, different kind of team to deal with, and it's not uncommon for it to take some adjustments for a team to get used to it and how to defend them. They got obviously need to keep James Harden out of the paint. And, you know, the Lakers just seemed a little flat-footed. And on top of that, look, you know, on the real part of this – you know, there are real concerns. The Lakers, you know, didn't look, haven't looked spectacular in the bubble period. And, you know, their supporting cast around the two stars has always been a little bit suspect. So that's not to say I think that the Rockets are going to steal this series. But, you know, my first reaction is the Lakers will be fine. My secondary reaction is, but they do have some roster concerns. And I don't know if that will end up haunting them in this series or not.
Well, yeah, I mean, P.J. Tucker did a really good job against Anthony Davis. I think sometimes they get a little caught up in trying to match up a hunt there. Obviously, it's a different type of team to deal with. LeBron said the team speed Houston brings to the table. They spread you out. You know, though James has lost, I think, 6 of his last 7 game ones and won most of those series. I think the biggest concern I had was with the rotations last night, Howard. I mean, where does the decision-making come in to play Rajon Rondo 25 minutes after he hasn't played since March, considering how well Caruso was playing alongside LeBron? And then when I just look at a general fit standpoint, like when Rondo's in the game, he's either taking the ball out of LeBron's hands or taking some of the spacing away on the court.
Yeah, that was as baffling to me as it was to everyone else. You know, I could play contrarian on this, but I don't even know where to go with the contrarian argument. I mean, the only justification really is we want to deepen the rotation. We do want to take a little bit of the ball handling burden off of LeBron at times, and we need Rondo in rhythm to do that, and we think we're going to need him later in this series and in subsequent series. So let's get him going and reacclimated. And it'll pay off down the line, even if we made some short-term sacrifice. Like, that would be the way to frame it. But Rondo hasn't been Rondo for years. I mean, there are flashes here and there, but the Rondo that people think of is like, oh, he's this great defender and playmaker. Like, no, he's not much of a defender anymore. He's still a terrible shooter. As a playmaker, yes, if he dominates the ball long enough per possession, he will eventually make a play. But when you have one of the greatest playmakers in the history of the game on your team in LeBron James, taking the ball out of his hands doesn't seem very wise. And again, if it's all a matter of just like, we want to, you know, put a little more depth in the rotation and just work him in, that's one thing. But yeah, too many minutes, too much of a role last night after too long of being off. I don't get it either. I don't know that that's the sole reason that they lost, or even a primary reason, but it was a baffling maneuver.
If I was a fan of the Lakers, that would be my biggest concern moving forward, to some of those rotation decisions. Because like you said, I mean, it makes sense to me if, all right, the second unit, you want somebody who can create and you're giving him those minutes. But just the minutes he played alongside LeBron and some of the other personnel that were out there on the floor. Let's shift gear to the East and the Miami Heat getting set to sweep, it looks like, the Milwaukee Bucks. I'm not actually surprised that Miami is going to go on and win this series. I'm certainly surprised it's going to be in the fashion that it looks like it's going to be. And Howard, when you see that, you react and you go, okay, you know, what led to this? Let's first start from the Bucks' point of view. Mike Budenholzer is getting some criticism, and I think now that you saw what he did with Atlanta and what's happened with his Milwaukee teams, it's fair to point out in the playoffs, sometimes his formula hasn't worked quite as well. There were questions about how many minutes he played his star players. I think maybe the Bucks overachieved a little bit, and we built up their roster a little bit more better than it actually is in reality. And then there's the fact that Giannis, simply as a star-level player, struggles to get his own shot. What would you identify as the chief issue for what's happened to Milwaukee here?
Well, I mean, I would echo a lot of what you said, and I was one who, first, I picked the Heat to win this series, but as you said, I didn't expect it would be necessarily in a sweep, which is where it's looking like this is going. Two, I have been raising, warning flags for months, going back to, you know, before the season stopped in March, that I didn't think the Bucks were as dominant as their record indicated, that this was a team that they're very good. They do what they do very well. And in the regular season, it makes them dominant. But the gap between them and the rest of the East, not just Miami, Toronto and Boston, too, I would have put in that discussion, and I usually did, that these teams were right there. And, in fact, had arguably better talent, especially 2 through 7 or 2 through 8, than the Bucks did. Their supporting cast is well-calibrated to play off of Giannis. and take advantage of all of his ability to break down a defense and make passes. But there are no other playmakers of note. And they have guys who also have histories of kind of gagging in the postseason. And if you wall off Giannis, which is what Toronto did last year, which is what Miami is doing now, and you turn him into a jump shooter, he can't make jump shots. And once you have kind of stifled the flow of their offense, suddenly he doesn't have a lot of, you know, ton of open teammates anymore, and they can't create their own shots. And most of them, while they were a great volume shooting three-point team, they weren't a great efficiency three-point team. So everything just starts to unravel. And it just shows that, you know, you can be dominant in the regular season and the formula may not carry over. And, you know, we've seen that with other teams before, but that's really what this comes down to. And, you know, Chris Middleton is a nice second banana, but he's, I've said this many times too, and Bucks fans are always offended by it. He's not your typical co-star for a championship caliber team. This is not like LeBron and Wade in Miami or Steph and KD or even Kawhi and Paul George or on. So they're in trouble. I mean, and it's not obviously in today's NBA. It's never about, you know, you're in trouble because you might lose a series. It's you're in trouble because you might lose your star, and that's going to be the bigger story for months to come.
Yeah, that is definitely the talking point has already started. Hey, here's a question for you. You know nothing else about the situation, but I'm telling you, you can have your pick of one of these two guys heading into a playoff series. Who you taking, Giannis or Jimmy Butler?
Jimmy Butler, but I would have said that even before this, and I swear that's the case. Like, one, I've always remained a big fan of Jimmy Butler's game and of his just overall persona. I know that it doesn't fly as well in today's NBA, but look, I covered Kobe Bryant for 7 years in L.A. and, you know, obviously subsequent years here in New York, but 7 years up close, Jimmy Butler has a lot of Kobe Bryant in him. It is that kind of old school alpha dog, and it rubs some people the wrong way. And it's not always, you know, look, I'm not going to justify everything he's ever done or said, but it has its own power to it. The way he carries himself, the confidence that he has, but also, you know, Jimmy was, I think, this ideal star for a Miami Heat team where he didn't need to dominate the ball. You look at his regular season stats. They were just fine. They didn't leap off the page, but you knew you could always count on him in crunch situations, and you can. He can go from 40 points in game one to whatever it was in game two, just more of a complimentary role, and he's going to bust his butt on defense, and that team has taken on his personality and his confidence. And, you know, he's just one of those big-time performers when it matters, and he wants it. He wants the ball. He wants the responsibility. No, I love everything about Jimmy Butler and his game, and yes, there's the big difference between being able to, and I'm not saying that this means Giannis's numbers were empty by any stretch. I voted for him for MVP at the top of my ballot. But there's a big difference between what you can do in a regular season under certain circumstances and what you do in the heat of a playoff battle.
Robin Lundberg talking to Howard Beck, senior NBA writer for Bleacher Report here on CBS Sports Radio. One more topic I want to get your thoughts on, Howard, and that's the Nets hiring of Steve Nash. I was a little surprised by some of the reaction to it, obviously much of that fueled by Stephen A. Smith's comments. To me, you know, there are discussions to be had clearly about, you know, hiring practices and who's getting second opportunities and all that sort of stuff. But in this specific instance, I look at this and go, I think Steve Nash got this job mainly because he's Steve Nash. You know, the precedent has been set where great players get a crack at coaching when they want, that heady winning guards get a crack at coaching when they want. And then you factor in his connection with Sean Marks and connection with Kevin Durant. And it just doesn't seem logical to me to go anywhere else other than that's why Steve Nash was hired here.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there, but let me start with this list. And these are the guys who went straight to head coach from playing without ever being an assistant coach. Isaiah Thomas did it. Larry Bird did it. Jason Kidd, Derek Fisher, Mark Jackson, Steve Kerr, who of course followed Mark Jackson, and Doc Rivers back when he first got the job in Orlando. And it ruffled feathers at the time 20 years ago. George Karl made some unfortunate remarks about Doc Rivers skipping the line back then. So both black players and white players have benefited from their standing in the league to become head coaches without, you know, quote unquote, paying your dues as an assistant coach. And now Steve Nash has done the same. And I understand, especially in today's environment in 2020, when, we are discussing, as we should, a lot of issues of race and equity, and not, you know, most of it not about the NBA, but obviously the NBA has been, you know, a flashpoint for a lot of this. Their own discussions have been quite prominent. So, of course, this should get some scrutiny. And I have no problem with the discussion or the scrutiny. But to your point, I do think that in a vacuum, the Nets made a logical decision. Steve Nash wanted to coach. Steve Nash was one of the smartest players out there when he was playing. He's a two-time MVP. He has credibility. And he's been out of the game for several years and, you know, worked as a consultant with the Warriors. So he wasn't on the bench, but he played a kind of an assistant coach development type role or a development coach role. So it's not like he has no experience at all. And the bond with Kevin Durant that he formed while working for the Warriors matters. And especially when Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, you know, with all the expectations that are coming with them for next season, of course they're going to have some influence in this decision, in this hire. So, you know, look, he's not the first to do this. He probably won't be the last to do this. The last note I would just say is that when it comes to judging the NBA or teams on their hiring practices with respect to race, you know, the Nets, I think four of their prior six coaches were black. So it's not like they have some long streak of not giving opportunities to black coaches. They had Jason Kidd. They had Avery Johnson. They had Lionel Hollins. They had Byron Scott back in the day. They had Billy King as their GM at a time when he was probably one of like two black executives leading a basketball operations department. So the Nets are not guilty of anything here in particular. The league does still have widely or broadly a problem in that there are only five black coaches at the moment in a league that's 80% black. There are four vacancies, and so the number may return back to what it's been the norm the last few years, which has been more in the, you know, 7-8 range. But that is also, I would argue, too low.
Yeah, and I would echo anybody who says Tyronn Lue needs to be hired, and I think that's going to happen with Philadelphia. But we will see in the coming days. Howard, enjoy the rest of the playoffs. I'm sure we'll talk soon.
Appreciate it, Robin. Thank you.
Miss any of the show? Catch up with the Robin Lundberg podcast, available all week on the weekend page at cbssportsradio.com.
Yeah, what he just said. Make sure you check it out. Also, cbssportsradio.com, radio.com, Apple Podcasts, available, I think, pretty much all those platforms. So if you missed any of the discussions from today, never fear. You can get them later at your leisure, at your convenience. So if you want to know what I had to say about the Lakers and the Rockets, or the Bucks and the Heat, or Steve Nash being hired by the Nets, or Cam Newton and the Patriots, the approach of the NFL season, that's all there. You got a few more minutes to weigh in at 855-212-4227. But right now, I'll get to every topic I have not as of yet in another one.
It's time for another edition of Another One on the Robin Lundberg Show. The rumors, reports, and ridiculous from the week that was. Here's Robin Lundberg.
All right, Anthony, what's up first, man?
All right, you had touched on this with Howard briefly, but as we all know, the Bucks are on the brink of elimination, and Giannis feels like he can be doing more. After last night's loss, he was asked about his minutes, and Giannis said, "I feel great. Yeah, I could play more." He played 37 in Game 1, 36 in Game 2, and 35 minutes in Game 3. Now, it did look like he tweaked his ankle last night, but should Giannis be playing more minutes?
I think the easy answer is if you're trying to win games, yeah. I mean, look, it's the playoffs. And I know afterwards Budenholzer said something like he thought the level of play, what they're playing, how hard these guys are playing, that 36, 37 is the threshold, is like as far as you can push it. Yo, dude, you were down 2-0. Going into last night, the difference between 2-0 and or 2-1 and 3-0 is enormous. I mean, look at the way you might feel about the Celtics and the Raptors today compared to what it would be if it was Boston 3-0. And I just don't understand. Like, I understand load management. I understand wanting guys to get rested. I understand not burning guys out in the regular season. I understand they're playing every other day in the bubble. But why are the Bucks stars different than other team stars? That's what I don't quite understand. Because Sometimes you will see guys on other teams extended to 38, 39, even 40 minutes at a time. And in a must-win game, that's when you got to do it. I'm not saying you don't want to be going over those numbers every game, because you certainly don't. But every now and again, yeah, you got to touch higher numbers than that. When you're in a situation like they were last night. You know, I think overall I actually agree with his minutes distribution. You know, that's about the right number. 36, 37, whatever would be about the right number. Giannis played 35 last night. It's not like the other guys played on the other teams played too much more than he did. I mean, I was looking at some of the stats. Some of the other guys hit 37, 38, some of the other star players. So it's only a couple minutes. But in a game like last night, you know, that's when you have to dip into the reserves. And Giannis could have got, let's just say, three more minutes, and he's at 38. 38's not – people play 38 minutes all the time. That's not a crazy number. So that's the kind of thing I think many are pointing out. What's next?
Another one.
Sticking with the NBA, there have only been five unanimous winners of the NBA's Rookie of the Year award in history, and Ja Morant was almost part of that group, but he fell one vote short, and someone voted for Zion Williamson, and many people were upset, including Morant. Do you have a problem with someone voting for Zion?
I mean, I guess you could vote for who you want. I don't really understand it. That would be my problem. I mean, look, Zion's production was worthy of a Rookie of the Year vote. Sure, it's production. But he played in 24 games. As impressive as he was in 24 games, Ja Morant played the entire season. You know, Ja Morant played 67 games. That's three times as many games. So there's just no way you can convince me, when you're taking that into consideration, that Morant is playing three times as much while also playing at a high level, that Williamson had a better rookie season. He may have had the best individual game. I'd have to go look at it. He may be the guy you considered to be the best rookie just from a production standpoint. But Ja Morant was the Rookie of the Year, and I think that was pretty clear. And, you know, it's always a pretty clear thing when you see everybody but one person voted that way. You know, it's rare you get a unanimous decision, so I don't want to I don't know that person's reasoning. I just don't know, holding up to the logic, how anyone could be the Rookie of the Year when they're missing, you know, two-thirds of the season, essentially. What's next?
Another one.
So the Big Ten and Pac-12, they're examining a path back to playing in 2020. But Clemson head coach Dabo Swinney said Thursday that the college football playoff should not wait for either conference. No, Swinney said. No, we're ready to roll, and that would be something that I wouldn't want to be in favor for. I'm all in favor of the play-in. I'd love for them to play. That'd be great, and I think testing is a great opportunity for everyone, for sure. But it'd be kind of hard to start in November and then get in there. But we would want to push the season into February and all that stuff. We're going to push forward. If it changes, it changes, but that's where we are right now. So do you agree with Sweeney? Should the college football playoff not wait for the Big 12, for the Big 10 and Pac-12?
It depends on what they do, right? Like, I don't know. If it's feasible, if they decide, the Big 10 says, all right, we're going to play in November, right? And you could have the you know, you delay the college football playoff by a month or something like that. Maybe it's something you consider. I understand Sweeney's point of view. He's like, we are playing, you're not, sorry. You know, like, that's I say that without judgment. I don't mean one's right or the other is not. But you have to start dealing with your own reality. And once the Big Ten and the Pac-12 decided they were going to postpone their seasons and the other conferences decided they were going to go on with it, I worked on the assumption that the other conferences would figure out their own structure. So they're trying to move on and figure it out. So I get his point of view. I would be willing to reconsider should the circumstances change, but as they are now, yeah, I mean, I think fundamentally he's essentially correct. They are now adjusting to the reality that's in front of them, and that reality that's in front of them is a college football season where the Big Ten and the Pac-12 aren't playing, at least in the near future. What's next?
Another one.
All right, finally, Robert Downey Jr. said once again this week that he's put Iron Man and the MCU behind him in an appearance on the Smartless podcast with Jason Bateman, Sean Hayes, and Will Arnett. Downey said his MCU time is all done. Of course, Downey first played Tony Stark in 2008, as Iron Man, the first film in the MCU, and then his last major appearance came last year in Avengers Endgame. Do you think we'll ever see Robert Downey Jr. again in the MCU?
I don't want to say no to that. I don't think that is quite to, you know, definitive. Those things can always change.
Yeah, I don't think either. Plus, I do think he'll be making a cameo in Black Widow.
Well, that's also a prequel, right?
Yes,
so
he could have already
filmed that.
Exactly, yes. But so I do think that will happen.
Look, if they're going to bring his character back, it could be through flashbacks. It could be through stuff like that. If he was actually going to come back, the storyline would just have to be tremendous, or else you lose the gravitas of that moment and of that entire character arc, right? The entire Tony Stark character arc that started in Iron Man, which was the first MCU movie, and ended in Endgame, which was the end of Phase 1 for the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So I would never suggest that they do that flippantly or just to, you know, cause a buzz or a stir. I just would never rule something like that out, especially considering how successful it was for Robert Downey Jr. It rebuilt his career.
I don't think it's going to be like a prominent role. Like, I don't think we'll see like an Iron Man 4, but I do think at some point down the line we'll see him again.
He's also getting older too, right? So that could factor into who knows what they do with multiverses or you know, flashbacks, like I said, or in the future, parallel universe, whatever. I mean, there's stuff that could make it happen, but I think the story has to be right. And I also don't think, let's just put it this way, I don't think he factors into the plans right now. They're not planning it around him, and he's not planning his life around that. And they told the story that they wanted to tell, and I think they did it successfully. So that's the way I will remember that character until something changes, and I'm not sitting around wondering if he's going to wind up back. If he does, I would hope there is good reason for all involved. It's always a good reason for you to check out the show. At least I hope. I always have a good time doing the show. Like I said, you can grab the podcast, you know, CBSSportsRadio.com. I'll be back next week, same time, same place, 6 to 10 a.m. Eastern here on CBS Sports Radio. Ken Carman's coming up next. It's been the Robin Lundberg Show here on the aforementioned CBS Sports Radio.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.